Welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Vegan, psychologist, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, a marriage and family therapist and licensed professional counselor. But I have a special announcement to make because Shelley has, as of last month, been licensed by the Louisiana State Board as a psychologist. Shelley, congratulations.
Thank you.
How many years has it taken in terms of training and education to become a psychologist?
Over a decade.
Over 10 years.
Yes.
Well, this is an honor and a responsibility that I'm so proud of you, and I just really congratulate you.
I'm glad it's over.
Shelley will be taking over the role as the host for the Mental Health Matters section of Health Matters here at Red River Radio. And I'll be merely filling in the past or in the future if and when she is absent. Is that all right with you, Shelley?
That works for me.
Okay. Well, tonight, ladies and gentlemen, listeners at Red River Radio, we are going to be talking about methamphetamine addiction this evening. As our guest, we have licensed addiction counselor and CADA Clinical Developmental Director Kent Dean. Kent, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
And we have child advocacy attorney Nancy Cooper, who works primarily, as I understand, Nancy, at the juvenile court. Is that right?
Yes, primarily,
Well, welcome as well.
Thank you.
Later on in the program, my hope is that Dr. Nick Getters from LSU Medical in, I guess Nick is in toxicology and pharmacology and brain science of all kinds, who also is an expert in methamphetamine abuse and drugs of addiction. He will be joining us hopefully as well. So we have a really excellent panel, both here in Kent Dean and Nancy Cooper. Kent, would you just take a minute and tell our listeners at Red River Radio who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a counselor and a teacher, and I specialize in addictive and co-occurring disorders. And as the clinical development director for CADA, I get to oversee the clinical training needs of the staff and also to do outreach, just like this program.
Now what is CADA?
The Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse of Northwest Louisiana.
Okay, so it's an acronym. All right, Nancy, tell us about you.
Well, I am one of the attorneys with the State Mental Health Advocacy Service and the Child Advocacy Program. We represent children who've been removed from their families for abuse or neglect, and we also represent children who have been involuntarily admitted to psychiatric facilities.
So, Nancy, just say a word about how does your role and what you're seeing at the juvenile court, what are you seeing regarding methamphetamines?
Well, we are seeing, and especially in Caddo Parish, a lot of children removed from their families because of methamphetamine use by a parent. That's become a pervasive problem lately. And our judge, Judge Matlock, who handles our child in need of care proceedings, is on a mission right now to figure out what is going on and why people are using methamphetamine and why children are actually getting exposed to it in the household.
Well, I know each time I've been down at the juvenile court, all those judges care a great deal about what they're doing.
Yeah, yes, very much. And Judge Matlock, his particular caseload is our child in need of care. So he handles abuse and neglect proceedings and removals.
Okay. Well, I want to remind you, our listeners, to call in and join us 1-800-552-8502 here at Red River Radio, or you can send in a note at www.redriverradio.org. Kent, can we start off by me asking you just sort of a basic question? What are methamphetamines?
Well, methamphetamine is a stimulant. It's part of a group of substances known collectively as amphetamines, of course, and it can be a white powder or a pill, and crystal meth looks like glass or shiny bluish-white rocks, and it can be taken into the body by snorting, smoking, or by injection.
Gosh. Okay.
All sorts of ways to get it in there.
Methamphetamines or amphetamines are known. Are there other names that are, I mean, how do people call these things on the street?
Well, there's some slang names, some of which I can't say on the radio, but the ones I can say include things like crank, chalk, or crystal, fire, meth, of course, speed, and ice.
Hmm. if you were a parent listening in the Red River radio listening area, and you had a son or a daughter, and you didn't know much about methamphetamine abuse, and a son or a daughter were beginning to use meth or crystal, or as you say, fire, crystal, coke, crank, what would you as a parent see?
What would I see?
What would you see in that child?
Well, the first effect of methamphetamine typically is extraordinarily positive. Being a stimulant, it just makes the person feel super good, and it makes them feel as though they are immortal and just can't do anything wrong. It really seems to give people a temporary new lease on life. It seems like heaven on earth.
So, but not just a good mood, an incredibly good mood that's very unusual.
Yeah.
Does it look like manic behavior?
Could be. At extremes, it can even be psychotic behavior, maybe hallucinations and all of that. But in the beginning stages, it can be so rewarding that the person, understandably, I guess, if they have trouble with self-esteem or if they have trouble with attention deficit, it can seem to be such a powerful solution to the problems that they're having that that adds to the reward also, in addition to its simple effects in the brain.
So if a child starts out with attention deficit disorder or or hyperactivity disorder, he probably has it's probably irritating to people around him, like parents.
Yep.
And it probably is difficult for him in school.
Yep.
And he probably doesn't learn well because of this attention deficit disorder.
Correct.
And so he doesn't do well in school and he begins to fail. Does this mm-hmm. sound familiar?
Yes, it does.
This cascade of symptoms.
That's right.
And then he starts, somebody gives him some meth. What happens to him?
Well, given the way meth works in the brain, the child will notice a fairly rapid, this is true for adults too, they'll notice a fairly rapid increase in the ability to focus, to stay on task, to think at a relatively faster rate of speed, and an apparent, maybe illusory, but an apparent ability to think things through much more quickly and much more decisively, which can only help. Certainly with schoolwork, memorization will improve because it also has effects in memory. And first, the problem with a drug like meth is that in the early stages of the use, it provides so much in the way of reward and apparent solutions that to get somebody at that point to see that what they're doing is highly dangerous and ultimately extremely detrimental, that's a tough sell.
Of course, we're talking about the difference between amphetamines that are prescribed medically and under the careful protocols imposed upon patients by physicians.
Sure, for things like ADHD.
Because we see kids and adults with ADHD who have been properly treated by a psychiatrist, and the positive effects of the use of amphetamines.
Sure.
But that's very different than getting methamphetamines off the street.
Right. For one thing, as is always true of street drugs, you're not really sure what it is you're getting, and you have absolutely no idea of its potency or even if it's what it's purported to be, because there's a lot of bootleg meth on going around that's made from not from the ingredients of pharmaceutical meth, but from things like decongestants like pseudoephedrine.
So that's really an issue of taking street drugs. Of course, all street drugs, no one really knows what it is you're taking if you're buying drugs off the street.
That's
or...
Right.
Trading things for drugs.
And it could be adulterated with other chemicals. It's just no telling what you're putting into your body.
Yeah, Nancy, do you want to jump in here on any thoughts about these ideas?
Well, sure. Kent's remarks about the ADHD or the reasons behind people's use is something that we are really trying to explore over in juvenile court. We are seeing cases come back a lot. We'll remove a child because of drug use. We go through the whole case plan. Every time a child's removed in juvenile court, we put together a team of people that work with the parents to try to reunify the family. And that can be drug counselors, addiction counselors, therapists, mental health counselors, attorneys, everybody. If we're able to send a child back home, if meth is involved, those children are being re-removed. And that's a problem we're seeing over and over again in families that are using methamphetamines in particular. So we're having some disturbing outcomes with methamphetamine in terms of keeping families together.
So y'all are seeing real high relapse rates.
Very high relapse rates. In fact, we're collecting, Judge Matlock is working to collect data on that. And his big push right now is to try to investigate what is going on with these people that causes them to start methamphetamine in the first place. And what we're realizing is how many of them, especially the mothers, have experienced some form of childhood trauma, particularly sexual abuse as a child. So there's a whole movement now coming out of juvenile court to start to get trauma-informed counseling and treatment for the mothers that are using methamphetamines.
Now, Kent, you were just shaking your head when Nancy was talking about...
Yeah, I have something I'd like to add to that. The current definition of addiction by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, they have a long definition and a short definition. The long definition goes into some, goes on at some length about the basis of trauma in forming addiction in vulnerable people, along with genetics and other factors. So that is very much in line, Nancy, with what we're seeing clinically also. It used to be that PTSD, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, was something that we ruled in if it seemed to be present. And now it's so prevalent in the people that come to see us that we actually have to rule it out. And that's hard to do.
So what you're saying is that people exposed to sexual abuse or other kinds, I imagine, physical trauma in their developmental years are going to be more at risk.
Yes.
Will you finish that sentence
for me? They're going to be more at risk for developing addiction. The ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine definition, includes factors certainly such as genetics, the presence of trauma in the life of the person at some point, typically in childhood, problem with what they call executive function, which is similar to attention deficit disorder, staying on task and doing things in the right order and that kind of thing. There are several factors that go together in the perfect storm to make an addict, and certainly trauma seems to be one of them.
Again, I ask you, our listeners, to call in, join our conversation here at Red River Radio. The number to call is 1-800-552-8502. Shelley, did you want to add anything at this point? Or I was going to ask a couple more questions of Kent and Nancy.
Well, I was just thinking, as we deal a lot with people who have experienced trauma, it makes sense that they would be drawn to something like meth, because people who have experienced trauma often do have low self-esteem. They have problems getting out and associating with others, and if this lifts their mood and their self-esteem, then it's a very quick fix to an otherwise really complex problem.
The key word there is quick. It really is fast. That's part of the problem.
Yeah. I wanted to ask another question, and my hope is that the hosts of Health Matters, Dr. Randy Brewer and Dr. Sandy Katz, might be listening, because they might want to call in and help us with this question. But, Kent, does meth have any kind of legitimate uses in medicine? I know that's kind of a medical doctor question. And
well, in the research I've done more recently, it is still used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and for short-term appetite control. But what I've seen is that prescribers seem to be kind of moving away from use of methamphetamine for anything because of the problems that can attend its use. And you never know who's going to be more vulnerable to developing difficulty with it. And more it's seen maybe is not worth the effort, that there are other medicines that can be used pretty much for anything meth is good for with far less risk.
So generally your studying of the research is that there's really very little use other than for attention deficit disorder with prescription by a qualified medical provider who understands that complex symptomatology.
That's right.
Okay. In terms of talking about, you know, Nancy and Kent, abuse, how prevalent in the United States and how prevalent in our listening area here, the Northwest Louisiana, you know, East Texas, in our listening area, what about prevalence of methamphetamine abuse?
Well, I have some national statistics. Nancy, do you want to talk about local?
I was going to ask you, actually. We feel like we have more meth up here in Caddo we've got to have more than the average. And we hear from our offices down in South Louisiana, they tend to have more heroin problems. But for whatever reason up here, and we wonder if it's because we have a lot of rural, outlying parts of our parish, and this stuff is just made in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a prescription involved ever.
Right.
And so I wondered if y'all see more meth up here than y'all do, in other parts of the state.
I think I could say that we do. Now, I'm relatively new at CADA, but that's my impression from talking with other clinicians. And the thing about meth is, as we alluded to earlier, it can be presented in bootleg form, and it's opioids like heroin and morphine and other painkillers generally are off the street in their prescription form, but methamphetamine can be had on the street as methamphetamine and also kind of a bootleg meth, which is much cheaper. And as we are aware, this part of the state tends to have a lot of rural areas and a lot of people who are of lower economic status. So that something like methamphetamine, given its relative lack of expense, might be much more prone to be abused than something like an opioid.
Shelley, I think we have a caller coming in.
Yes, we do. We have Kenny from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Kenny.
Good evening. I believe this has been addressed about the kids with ADD using meth, maybe as a self-prescription. But I had heard a while back, and I had a little bit of medical background, that someone with ADD, meth calms them down rather than speeds them up.
That's right.
Is that correct, or did I hear that wrong? Or because another one of the doctors talked about meth being used as treatment for ADD, and I was thinking that was the reason, because it kind of gives them a more normality. But then there's a problem of addiction, of course.
Well, that's right. As you know, attention deficit disorder kind of comes in two flavors. One is with hyperactivity, and then the other is without, what they call predominantly inattentive type. And in terms of the hyperactivity, it's a bit of an odd thing.
Paradoxical effect.
Yeah, a stimulant can actually slow down a part of the brain called the blue spot or locus coeruleus, which contributes to some of the hyperactivity. So it does have that paradoxical effect. It doesn't have that effect on people who don't have hyperactivity, but the non-hyperactive type of ADD to this day is still missed perhaps a good more in diagnosis and treatment than the hyperactive type because it's so obvious.
I guess what you're saying is it's easier to see a hyperactive child than just a child with attention deficit disorder.
That's right.
But did I understand you to say that, or what did you say about stimulants and like Ritalin or Strattera, those kind of medications, and their effect on ADD kids with just attention deficit disorder, no hyperactivity disorder?
Well, any stimulant is going to have the paradoxical effect for people who have hyperactivity. It's going to help people slow down and focus, but it's also going to have the effect, which is not paradoxical, of speeding up the front of the brain and the way it operates. And that's the part of the brain that we use to think and reason and planning and all of that. And so that part of the brain actually does get sped up. It's almost like overclocking your own brain, going everything in fast forward. But the idea is that since in untreated ADD, the brain really isn't working in some ways fast enough, so this whole process of using amphetamine or some other stimulant speeds things up to something approaching normal. The problem is that something like methamphetamine overshoots that, typically, and the person finds themselves, once again, in fast forward. It's kind of that's a paradox also. It helps at first, but then it turns out making everything worse.
Again, we invite you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation, and I thank Kenny for calling in regarding his question about ADD. Call in at 1-800-552-8502 and join our conversation. I think what I'd like to ask a little bit, Kent, you're a long-time addiction disease counselor. Could you just remind our listening audience, what is addiction?
Well, in simple terms, addiction is an abnormal need or craving for certain substances or behaviors like gambling, and it's brought about by progressive damage to parts of the brain that actually help us appreciate when something feels good. They're called reward centers.
Okay, it's damage to the brain centers. You know, I've always thought about addiction as a primary relationship with a chemical or a primary relationship with a behavior like gambling, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have the primary relationship with a chemical, it interferes with relationships with sons and daughters, wives and husbands,
That's
brothers
right.
and sisters, and relationships with employers.
And it does so in a way that's really insidious, because active addiction, at least on the surface, the chemicals are so easy to get. And, you know, you don't have to be nice to a chemical. You don't have to work to relate to it. All you have to do is put it in your body, and it's going to do what you want it to do, at least until it stops doing what you want it to do.
Can you define for our listening audience the ideas of tolerance and reverse tolerance?
Well, the idea is if somebody takes in a chemical, and this is true of any human being, but it's certainly extra true of addicts, people who take in enough of a chemical long enough are going to find that the body and the brain try to, in a sense, defend themselves and stay in balance by beginning to ignore what they're taking. And that's where tolerance comes from. It takes the effect externally of having to take more and more of a chemical and getting less and less of an effect. But you can only do that a certain period of time. And one of the things I want to hit really hard tonight is this idea of overdriving parts of the brain. This is why prevention is key. You cannot overdrive any part of the human body long enough without having some sort of permanent damage. You know, we had the solar eclipse not too long ago, and we were warning people not to look directly at the sun, because if you do that, you're going to burn out your eyes, basically. I have hearing aids because I was exposed to an explosion, and my hearing apparatus was overdriven enough that now I don't hear like a normal person without hearing aids. And the same thing is true of the parts of the brain that register reward. If you overdrive them enough by revving them up too much, long enough, they're going to stop experiencing reward.
Okay. I think Dr. Nick Getters is on the phone. Nick, can you join us?
Dr. Getters?
Did we lose him?
I guess so. Maybe so. Maybe he will check back with us.
Dr. Getters, if you're listening, please call back. We want you to join us in this conversation. Okay. When he does call back, Kent, I may interrupt you, if that's all right.
Sure.
Okay. Let me also invite those of you who are listening, again, our number to call in if you want to join us, 1-800-552-8502. Kent, you give us a pretty good definition of addiction. Say it again in one sentence.
It's an abnormal need for a substance or an activity. It's an abnormal craving.
And it interferes with one's relationship with oneself and with everybody else.
It interferes with every bit of normal functioning.
Okay. And what are the symptoms that folks should be aware of in this might be Nick, no? Okay. What are the symptoms of methamphetamine addiction?
Well, the methamphetamine addict over time develops an ever-increasing need for the meth to maintain that good feeling or euphoria that they felt when they first began using it. And as we said before, initially meth users feel a high with a gloriously expansive or even gleeful outlook on life and on their ability to master life's challenges. Self-esteem takes a boost, energy and concentration spike. Everything is just like heaven on earth. And again, some people say they've never felt so creative and in tune with the joy of life. However, the problem is, if you do that very long, what goes up has to come down, and it comes down hard. So that greater doses of meth serve less and less well to provide that spike in good feeling. And before you know it, addicts are using more and getting less effect. It becomes more difficult to stay on an emotional even keel. Memory suffers, and all sorts of problems happen.
Okay. Shelley, do we have a caller?
Okay. I think that we have him now.
Dr. Getters, is this you?
Yes, you've got me.
Okay, great.
Hey, Nick.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for calling in and helping us out here. Have you been listening?
Yes, I have.
Talk to us about what you've heard and what you think we should add for the benefit of our listeners, please.
Well, everything that everyone said has been correct. As you said at the beginning, I'm a professor and head of the Department of Pharmacology, Toxicology, and Neuroscience, so
I do know a lot about the effects of drugs in the brain. And the thing, well, everyone's probably heard of something, a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And dopamine is the pleasure chemical. And everything that somebody likes to do, whether it's eating chocolate cake or a steak or going to a movie or sex or anything, is going to increase dopamine. And all of the different drugs that are used by people also increase dopamine. The thing about methamphetamine is it increases dopamine 10 to 100 times more than anything else does. And that's what tends to get people addicted to it so quickly, is because it produces such an intense high.
I'm just taking notes as you're speaking.
Okay. Some people do take it for ADHD, like you said. Other people take it because it does help them work longer. It helps them concentrate. Maybe they've got a deadline, or maybe they've got other responsibilities. It also is like most stimulants. It has what are called anorectic properties, so people can lose weight. They don't get as hungry if they're taking amphetamines. That they were prescribed way back in the 1960s for people to lose weight, but then they realized that these drugs were also harmful. So when you now get into the juvenile court system and the with Nancy and what she was talking about with the children and these families, in many cases, the primary caregiver of a child is going to be the mother. Many times it's a mother and father, but it's going to be the mother for sure. So imagine a mother who has a child to take care of, a house to take care of. She may have a job, and she may think, well, if I take some of this magical drug methamphetamine, I'll be able to do everything I need to do. And at the same time, it makes her feel good, and it helps her lose weight. It's like a magic pill or magic, it depends on how she takes it. And it's that way for a few days, maybe a few times when she takes it. But what happens, just as Kent was talking about, over time, it starts to produce less and less of that good effect that the person's seeking. So she'll take more, and she'll take more, and she'll take more until she gets to a point where she has to take meth just to feel normal, because she doesn't feel normal otherwise, because her body has become so used to that drug being in her body.
But that cascade of escalating use, Nick, seems, could we not say that also about barbiturates or sedative hypnotics or benzodiazepines, as well as alcohol or even the narcotics and the hallucinogens?
Absolutely. They all have this same effect, this tolerance that builds up over time, so someone needs more and more. The thing about methamphetamine, though, and this is something that's been shown using imaging studies where they image inside the brains of people who have been using methamphetamine, that because so much dopamine is released, that the dopamine becomes chemically altered in the brain and actually starts to damage the very cells, the very neurons in the brain that release the dopamine. And so over time, there's less and less ability to feel pleasure any longer because of the damage to these dopamine cells.
So, Dr. Getters, that brings up a question I was asking about earlier with Kent before the show, about mothers who are going through treatment, or mothers who they've been identified as meth users, and they have maybe been assessed, and they're participating in our family court program, our drug court program through the court, and they're testing negative, and they seem to have very little affect or bond with their child. It's like they're not producing dopamine, and it's the most heartbreaking thing to see the child rushing to the mother during a visitation, and the mother just sort of sits there, and she doesn't really respond to the child very well or at all. And where do we go from there?
Well, and that does happen, but if a person gets away from this, if they get away from the drug for a long enough period, the brain has a marvelous ability to correct itself, that over time things can start to get back to this equilibrium where things get back to normal, but it's going to take longer than 2 weeks. It's going to take longer than a month. It takes a long time for the brain to start recovering this function so that people start feeling normal emotions again.
So do you have any recommendations for Nancy or Kent or myself or Shelley, people that might be coming into contact with a mother who has had the use of these methamphetamines and excessive amounts of dopamine and damage to the receptor sites, as well as, who become flat, who become emotionally unresponsive to their child? How do we as clinicians, how do we help those women who are unresponsive, secondary to brain dysfunction, secondary to all this methamphetamine use and overdoses of dopamine?
Sure. The only thing I can see is to keep them away from the drug, keep them away from that drug environment for a long enough time for the brain to start to recover. There are treatment facilities that do have programs that are 90 days or even longer, that where people can go and give their brains a chance to get back to normal. And it does happen. I've seen it over and over again. People, that mothers who stay away from meth long enough, they start to become mothers again. It's never too late. It's never hopeless, but it's a matter of staying away from the drug and staying clean long enough to give the body and the brain a chance to recover.
Is there any way to speed that process up, or is it just something that's going to happen naturally and you just have to wait?
I don't know of any way to speed it up. I think each person is going to be an individual case, but I've seen cases where people, if they've been able to stay away long enough, they've been able to become productive members again. In society, I've seen other cases where they go back to where they, back to the environment where they used the drug before, and they see somebody that they used it with, or they, some other trigger in the environment, and before you know it, they're back exactly where they were when they came in for treatment.
I don't know, when Kent and I years ago were working with people in addiction disease units, we used to talk about getting new playmates and new play pens. Do you remember that, Kent?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Nick, can I ask you another question before you leave us? And that is, how is meth addiction treated from a biological point of view, or stated differently, are there any medications that are effective in treating meth addiction or helping to reverse the negative effects of methamphetamine addiction?
At this point, I'm not aware of anything. That's what's unfortunate. It's something that I've been studying in the lab for many years and trying to come up with something, but there's really nothing medically, any type of magic bullet that's going to reverse these changes from methamphetamine. The only way that's going to happen is to keep the person away from the drug and away from the environment and getting them new playmates and everything else that you said. That's really the only way.
Dr. Getters, at court, we hear a lot about methadone and Subutex. And there's clinics, I know, here in town that administer those drugs. And did those help? And we have criticisms about those drugs too, because people will get on those and we will say they're just a secondary addiction. But are those drugs something that can help a methamphetamine addict, or is that more for opioids or other type drugs?
Well, those are made for the opioid type drugs. But surprisingly, I've talked to a lot of methamphetamine users that get on these other drugs. And I think it's because they also, the Subutex that you were talking about, and possibly even methadone, they're going to affect dopamine too. So they're going to get a little bit of that dopamine response, nothing like they would see with methamphetamine, but they'd get a little bit of that dopamine response that may be enough to deal with their cravings. And so I don't know if anyone has actually looked at Subutex as far as a treatment, but I know that the meth users themselves, when they can't get meth, they'll use Subutex. And you'll oftentimes find them when they're arrested, they may have that along with any meth or anything else they may have.
Okay. Again, we ask our listeners to join us, if you would, 1-800-552-8502. We're here with Nancy Cooper and Kent Dean, and Dr. Nick Getters is on the phone with us. So come join us if you would like to. Shelley, can I go on and ask another question? Nick, if you're welcome to stay on the line and join us if you want. Thank you, though, if you can't stay longer.
No, I'll be happy to, as long as you'll have me.
Okay, good. I was going to ask, Kent was talking earlier about what are the symptoms of meth addiction. He was talking about, a high need for it, euphoria, expansion, self-esteem, great creativity, ability to do all kinds of things and feel omniscient. I was then going to ask him about what does it look like when somebody is in withdrawal or pulling back from it, or so on. What, Kent, can you speak to those issues?
Well, the old expression, what goes up must come down, and the idea in stimulant abuse is that if you take them away, even in the course of treatment, the withdrawal pretty much can be a mirror of the at least presumed benefits that they give. You get depression, you get lethargy, you get an inability to feel pleasure in much of anything, as we talked about. And some of that may be an anticlimax. I mean, it's like an astronaut who's been on the moon, and now he or she is merely standing on the top of Mount Everest. For most people, they would count that as a real accomplishment. But in contrast to having been on the moon, it's kind of small potatoes. Sources of malnutrition, tremors, movement problems, seizures, all sorts of long-term problems. But the base problem that people have to deal with is dysphoria and something called anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure, like Nick was talking about.
Can people die from withdrawing from methamphetamines?
I don't know that the actual withdrawal is generally considered life-threatening, although it's certainly not impossible. Long-term meth use can damage the heart and a lot of end organs and create faulty rhythms in the heart, and any disruption in that. If somebody's been using meth and they're developed an arrhythmia, like a fibrillation or whatever, and they stop using meth, that existing arrhythmia can perhaps get worse. I've heard of people having problems with that. They can have seizures. They can have all sorts of things. So it's not something to take lightly, and typically is best done in a detox-type facility.
Yeah. Dr. Getters, do you want to weigh in on that question of withdrawal?
Yeah, two different things. I'll weigh in on that first. And Kent was exactly right about the effects on the heart and other organs. A couple of years ago, the medical examiner in San Diego County wrote a piece for the paper out there saying that he sees more deaths associated with methamphetamine abuse than he does with opioids. And he was listing a lot of the effects on the heart and suicides and other causes of death that unless he looked for methamphetamine, that it might have been written off as something else, that this person might have had heart disease or this person might have just been upset and hurt herself. So it can be life-threatening either during withdrawal or because of the long-term use. But I did want to address another problem. When you said, how can you tell if somebody is using methamphetamine? And everything he said was exactly right, but something else that starts to arise in someone that's using methamphetamine, they start to become very distrustful. They start to become very isolated. They have paranoid delusional thoughts, and they think that someone is going to try to take their meth away from them, or they think that someone's going to try to make them stop using meth, and so they isolate themselves. this has a lot to do with that same neurotransmitter, dopamine. Dopamine has a lot to do with psychotic behaviors. And when someone is using methamphetamine, their dopamine levels are increased for hours at a time. With other drugs such as cocaine, it may be for 30 minutes at a time. With meth, it can be for hours at a time. And the person starts to exhibit this paranoid-type behaviors. So if someone has a friend or a loved one and they notice these behavioral changes, they become distrustful, they isolate themselves, there are really significant behavioral changes, one thing to suspect is substance abuse. And if they're very paranoid, I would certainly think that it could be the cause of methamphetamine or some other stimulant.
Okay. Nick, I'm Dr. Getters, I'm going to have to ask you to hang up. And the reason is that others may want to call in on the line that you are using. And okay. So I just want to thank you for participating. But at the same time, I may need to let others have your line. Is that okay with you?
Yes, it is. I just hope it wasn't something I said.
Thank you very much for contributing, and we very much appreciate your participation.
I was very happy to do so. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Again, we ask you, our listeners, to call in at 1-800-552-8502 and join us here at Red River Radio. We're talking about methamphetamine abuse. We're talking about addiction. We're talking about the effect on mothers, and then how that affects children of parents who have become addicted to methamphetamine and so on. Kent Dean is our guest, as well as Nancy Cooper.
We have Pam from Shreveport. She's on the line.
Okay,
Pam, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, I'm wondering if there's any clinical data or if there's anything to show that these children that suffered from ADHD that we were giving stimulants to as early as kindergarten, if those are the adults now that are more likely to abuse opiates or methamphetamines, is there anything that backs that up? We actually have been dealing with an opiate addiction in our family for about 7 years now, and I'm wondering if that's where it started.
Well, it could be kind of a chicken and an egg thing with addiction, since part of addiction development has to do with genetics and also obviously exposure to the substance or the behavior that the person gets hooked on. We do know that the earlier in life someone begins to use and abuse substances, the worse it can get at a faster rate. So it's possible, but I for one, wouldn't be willing to say that that's the primary reason. You know, the hardest thing in science is what they call causation, where to say A causes B. So I don't know that I would say that, but it's certainly something to be aware of, yes.
I think that's why it's very important that if young people and even adults are being prescribed these stimulant medications, that that prescription be written by a very competent and capable physician who's very knowledgeable about the conditions for which it's being used, how it's to be managed, the dosages that are to be given, and the constant monitoring of these medications in these particular patients. So very, very important.
That's the key word, Mark, is management. This is not something you write a prescription for and then tell the patient to, you know, see you later. This requires ongoing, it's a conversation that needs to keep on happening.
Right. Two people need to be involved in the conversation, the doctor as well as the patient.
Absolutely.
They need to be working very closely together. Again, I thank you, Pam, for your call. I invite others to call in at 1-800-552-8502. Kent, I had one, I probably have about 10 more questions, but let me ask this question. What are the symptoms of methamphetamine overdose?
Well, any of the benefits that meth can produce are going to be amplified in overdose. The euphoria, that good feeling, can reach psychotic proportions where the person's actually hearing voices. That euphoria can kind of spiral out into irritability, maybe even violence. And then the ability to think, it can really look a lot like bipolar disorder. And And so what we have to do is to be sure that what it is we're looking at, and of course a toxicological exam is the only way to really know that, but it mainly, it's an amplification of all the, at least early stage, benefits of meth use.
Okay. We have another caller.
We have another Pam, also from Shreveport. Pam, go right ahead.
Yes, I wonder if you could comment on the effects of methamphetamine on the developing fetus and young children. I was a CASA years ago, and two of the little girls that I had as clients, the 6 months old, couldn't raise her head, and the 5-year-old had developmental delays too. Both the parents used and manufactured methamphetamine.
Kent, that's way beyond me.
It's way beyond me, too. Clearly, anything that interrupts gestation is going to create all sorts of potentially horrific problems, and methamphetamine is no exception.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much any teratogen, which methamphetamine would be considered a teratogen, that's going to potentially Oh, I'm sorry. So any type of substance that's going to harm the fetus is called a teratogen. So meth would be considered a teratogen, so my assumption would be that it could cause some significant problems, but yeah, I'm not certain about that either.
Nancy, do you have any experience with that, with the juvenile court?
Well, that's funny. I was just talking about this with my partner, Laura Nanda, today, and we were trying to find data. We've always looked at this. I have a client who was born addicted to meth, and they put him on methadone for about 9 weeks, which I guess they thought that would help. I'm not sure why they did that, but we were looking to see if there was any data, and we really couldn't find anything. There was a lot of data on things like fetal alcohol syndrome, things that we've been researching for a long time. We were wondering if meth might be more recent and there hasn't been enough time to collect data on the long-term effects. I'm not sure.
Methamphetamine abuse has been around for many decades.
Okay. Another call, Shelley?
We're going to try. I've been trying to get to him for quite a while. Let's see if I can get to him. Elton, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay. Thank you for holding. I apologize. I've been trying.
Is this a famous attorney, Elton Ritchie?
Well, it's Elton Ritchie.
Oh, okay. Elton, go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mark. I wanted to follow up on the question that the lady asked about the connection between the prescription of Adderall to young children.
Yes.
And the follow-on addiction to methamphetamine, because I agree that the question of causation is probably the most difficult question in science as it is in the court system. But I see an awful lot of that. I've been doing this about 40 years now in the world of criminal law, and I have seen so many cases of young men, young women who started out with diagnosis of ADHD or ADD or whatever you want to call it, and thrown onto a prescription for Adderall or similar medication at a very young age with little to no follow-up by competent psychologist or psychiatrist and end up in the criminal justice system with a very serious and strong long-term meth addiction. So two questions. Number one, if your guest there could kind of comment on that and their observations and how it does lead to that or can lead to that. But more importantly, if they could talk about what a parent of a child who is being prescribed that type of medication can do to kind of ensure that it doesn't lead down that path to addiction. So I'll drop off if you want to turn me off, because I've kind of got you on my speaker on my cell phone.
Okay. Thank you for holding so long, Elton. We really appreciate it. I know you've been holding forever.
Kent, do you want to speak to Elton Ritchie's call?
Well, if somebody has attention deficit disorder, obviously it's a developmental problem. It's going to show up in childhood. And does that mean, then, that they are also extra vulnerable to developing addiction? As far as ADD and addiction goes, I don't know if you can say that. But again, one of the hallmarks of addiction is the same kind of what they call executive function problem that shows up in ADD. The question is, and you alluded to this earlier, Mark, if somebody is given Adderall, a child is given Adderall, and not monitored properly, then that leaves the window open for all sorts of mischief, because you just never know what can happen. These are risky medications. I'm not saying they shouldn't be given. That's not my place. And I've always been biased that there's no such thing as a bad drug, but if there were a bad drug, methamphetamine would be perhaps on the list. That said, if somebody is taking it for ADD and is monitored carefully and derives an appropriate kind of benefit from it, then far be it from me to say they shouldn't take it. But what does have to happen, however, is that better screening techniques have to be created to allow us to know earlier on whether somebody has, for example, markers for addiction, a genetic predisposition. Right now, that's really hard to ferret out. We can see it after it happens, but that's a little late. But assuming somebody does not have that predisposition, that vulnerability, and is given ADD medication, any ADD medication, and monitored properly over a long period of time, then it can have very beneficial effects. The problem comes, as you alluded to, in the lack of or the absence of adequate monitoring, then you've got all sorts of problems that can pop up.
Well, and children with ADHD, at least in my experience, appear to be more prone to self-esteem problems, mm-hmm. and doing poorly in school and things like that, which I would think could lead to using a drug like methamphetamine or opiates to kind of self-medicate,
right.
and try to compensate for those areas that they think that they're lacking, maybe.
That's right. They're trapped either way, because the problems caused by the ADD or ADHD are going to impair self-esteem. But then if they are, in fact, abusing a chemical such as methamphetamine that has initial beneficial effects on self-esteem, and then when you get this fatigue that sets in that Nick was talking about, and there's this damage, then the self-esteem plummets. So it's really kind of a double whammy.
I guess I want to put in a plug for some of the, we in psychology have some very sophisticated, elaborate, detailed, normed tests, performance tests that we use to make the diagnosis of attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. So
that's critically important as far as I'm concerned.
Well, so I think that's a tool in the psychologist's arsenal. If the psychologist is a specialist in child and adolescent development and so on, not all psychologists are. And then, of course, the psychiatrists have the skills to make that diagnosis as well.
One thing I'd add, too, and I don't know if all your listeners are aware of this, but attention deficit disorder does not go away when one leaves childhood and becomes an adult. It's a lifetime problem. And it can also show up in two forms, one, as we said, one with hyperactivity and one without. So it tends to get missed a lot in adults, but it can cause the same kind of difficulties in an adult that it does in an adolescent or a child.
We have seen in our practice some very high-functioning adults with extremely high levels of intellectual abilities who are professional people who have difficulty with attention deficit disorder.
Yes.
And we just spent a lot of money today ordering some two sophisticated tests designed to help us differentiate people who have attention deficit disorder, who have been compensating it for years, mm-hmm. with high levels of intelligence and performance and so on. Again, 1-800-552-8502. We may have time for one other question, but I do thank Elton for his question. Let's just talk a little bit about treatment, but I want to ask you, Nancy, a question. You've been working at the juvenile court how long now, you and Laura Nanda?
I've been with the agency about 5 years.
And Laura's been?
She's been about a little over a year, okay. But she was also doing legal services across the state before that, so yeah. She's got more experience.
So tell me what you've seen in terms of positive results from your work and the juvenile court's work with this particular problem of amphetamine abuse. What positive things have you seen, and what has worked for you?
Well, I guess it's hard to come up with a lot of positive things to say about meth, but one thing it's really done is triggered some new energy. I know at Caddo Juvenile Court, I think we have the best juvenile court system in the state, and we have such a dedicated staff there, and we have a lot of programs in place there that people don't even realize. And we have family preservation court And those people are just experts. They would make a great show, by the way.
Okay.
But they their whole goal is to try to reunify a family. So they're sort of treating the parents that are in their drug court programs from a holistic approach, and their big focus, like I said earlier, has really shifted towards trauma. And so they're trying to pull in more trauma treatment providers, which we realized there aren't very many in our area. And so not only have we been seeking those out, but the judge has been sending people off to programs where they can learn how to treat, how to provide trauma-informed counseling, and how they can teach other people to provide that counseling, and that not just therapists, but also foster parents and family members. Because in order to take care of a child who's been, you know, who's had some sort of trauma, you need to know how to deal with trauma. And in order to deal with parents who have been on methamphetamine because of trauma, because they're often linked, you need to know how to address trauma. So I would say lately one of the most positive things has just been an eye-opening of the vulnerabilities behind the methamphetamine use and a holistic approach towards treating it.
Kent, do you have any final comment for our listeners?
I would just like people to know that we've been talking about a lot of bad news this evening. Pardon me. But what I'd like people to remember is that there is some good news out there, too. This, as Nick said, this is treatable, and it gets nothing but better if the person gets the right kind of help. And that kind of help is readily available here in this area.
Okay. Explain to our listeners real quickly about CADA again and what it is and what the services are.
Well, we offer all sorts of services. Any kind of therapeutic service for addiction is available at CADA. Everything from medically supervised detox, residential programs, outpatient, intensive outpatient, and just all sorts of treatments are available. And we take all sorts of insurance. Nobody is ever turned away for the inability to pay, but okay, there's all sorts of help available.
I want to thank you very much, Kent Dean, for being here, and you, Nancy Cooper. And I want to thank Nick Getters for joining us this afternoon. I appreciate that, Nick, because it was late when I called you. And thank you very much, those of you who called in and joined our program. Again, this is Red River Radio Health Matters.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with his production assistance provided this evening by Tim Snell, Sheila Lawrence, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti, along with Dr. Mark Began. Thank you for joining us this evening.